Welcome. Robin is older today, officially. We have few in our church with the youth and vitality balanced by age as our dear friend Robin. So welcome. I'm Al. I'm your board rep today. Here's something great. This is the last board rep announcement for the year. So, Sue's given me 40 minutes, and I welcome you all. I invite you to share in our open search for truth and meaning in your life with us. I want to reinforce that we appreciate you all being here, whatever your race, your gender, your orientation, your religious perspective. We're glad to have you here to join us today. Phasers on sun, please. Stun, please. Thank you. In your order of service, there are a variety of announcements. Take a look at those. Please keep that order of service to refer to those. A couple of special reinforcements for you. Our first LCUC orientation class is scheduled for the 29th of this month. So if you're interested in attending that that class, please sign up. Or if you know people that you think might want to attend that, please remind them of that. Also, we'll have our first new member welcome service this year, and that will be on October 13th. Looking around the room, if you're visiting us for the first time, glad you're here. If you're not too embarrassed, stand up, wave, say hello, tell us who you are. That'd be great. Okay. There's no children's RE today, so I'll be staying in the service along with the rest of the children. If you have brought kids, you need child care, it is just out the door there for that, so great. Coffee, frivolity, deep discussion in the social hall after the service. Please join us there. At this point, again, with only 40 minutes, I invite you to greet one another. It's the hugs and hellos time.
Good morning. Hello. Hello. Okay.
Our speaker today, joining us from, did you ride the bike in today? No. Okay. Sue and her partner Linda have been with us as strong supporting friends, and will be joining the church officially in October. So that's a nifty thing. Sue is professor emerita in psychology with UW Colleges. She has a PhD in psychology from the University of Chicago and taught at UW Waukesha from 68 through to when she retired in 1998. In addition to the standard psychology courses, Sue with her colleagues in philosophy offered a variety of interdisciplinary courses on such mind-bending topics as the problem of good and evil, Sue says that ever since her college days, she has thought of herself as a devout atheist. It was only 5 years ago that she discovered she had also been a UU all along. So, welcome, Sue, and we look forward to learning how to make our table and our lives more welcoming.
At times, our own light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another person. Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have ignited the flame within us. For our opening hymn, let us rousingly sing Gray Hymnal 361, Enter, Rejoice, and Come In.
Enter, rejoice, and come in. Today will be a joyful day. Enter, rejoice, and come in. Open your ears to the song. Open your ears to the song. Today will be a joyful day. Enter, rejoice, and come in. Open your hearts, everyone. Open your hearts, everyone. Today will be a joyful day. Enter, rejoice, and come in. Don't be afraid of some change. Don't be afraid of some change. Today will be a joyful day. Enter, rejoice, and come in. Enter, rejoice, and come in. Enter, rejoice, and come in. Today will be a joyful day. Enter, rejoice, and come in.
We will read responsively number 596 in our hymnals. Let us cultivate boundless goodwill. Let none in anger or ill will wish another harm. Radiating friendliness over the whole world.
I'm going to do a story for all ages, and all ages tends to be at the upper end here, so if you wish to come down,
you're able to come down, you're certainly welcome to come down. Linda's going to help me here with the illustrations. If you come down, you'll be able to see them.
This is what we're coming down for.
This is horse fly and honeybee. Children are slower. Honeybee was tired. So she stretched and yawned and plopped down inside a flower for a nap. But Horsefly was inside the flower. They had a fight. It wasn't pretty. Horsefly lost a wing. Honeybee lost a wing too. Rat, said Horsefly, and he ran away. Rat, said Honeybee, and she ran away too. Honeybee started the long walk home. She walked slowly and took lots of breaks. Honeybee wasn't used to walking, but with just one wing, she couldn't fly. Then she came to a pond. What could she do? She couldn't fly over it. Suddenly, she was grabbed from behind. Crack, said Honeybee. Bullfrog lifted his lips as he carried her deep into the pond. He plopped Honeybee down on a lily pad, right next to Horsefly. Then Bullfrog went away in search of more dinner. Rat, said Horsefly. Rat, said Honeybee. They sat there for a long time. Horsefly pouted. Honeybee pouted. Horsefly moaned. Honeybee moaned. Then they heard Bullfrog coming back. Horsefly grabbed Honeybee. Honeybee grabbed Horsefly. They each and up they went. Rat, said Bullfrog. He hopped faster. He shot his sticky tongue into the air after them. But Horsefly and Honeybee were already out of reach. Rat, said Bullfrog. Together, Honeybee and Horsefly flew far away. They flew and flew, and finally they landed on a flower. And there was plenty of room for both of them. We are each of us angels with only one wing, and we can only fly by embracing one another.
Don't watch the children get up. That's not fair.
Hey, Jim. As noted in our order of service, now is the time when we invite all to share their joys and concerns with the congregation. So if you choose to share, please raise your hand and an usher will bring you a microphone. Please briefly tell us your name and the concern or joy that you wish to share. And I will light a candle to represent your joy or concern. In this sharing, may our sorrows be lightened and our joys multiplied. First, I will light our memorial candle to acknowledge the many conflicts of the world. May a peaceful resolution be found.
And I broke the whip. you all to share.
Hello, my name is Lynn. I'm a big Joys. I have my two daughters here. May is here from New York, and we'll be working this month on a girls' empowerment program for Liberia. And Jen will be starting her first job teaching math at the Verona High School. And they certainly are have lit my light. I remember your words, Sue, in the opening words. You know, and our wings when I need them. So.
I'm Diane, and I would like you to light a candle of concern for the citizens of Syria. I wish we could just stay out of there. No more killing, at least on our part.
Hi, I'm Barb. I would like to light a candle of joy. This is our first summer that we've had services every week, and it's just really been wonderful. I resisted the idea, but it's just been great, and all of you are just rolling it together.
My name is Eric. I'd like you to light a candle of joy for my daughter Katrina, who just left on the next chapter of her adventure. She's moving to Ithaca, New York. And it was hard to say goodbye, but I'm glad that she's off on another new adventure.
Yeah, this is Jerry. I'd like you to light a candle for our daughter Polly, who went through a very bitter divorce a few years ago and has suffered from a lot of problems with depression. But she and her boyfriend announced that they're engaged, and we hope that that lasts.
I'm Al. I'd like a candle of joy for Eric's hair regrowth. And pleased to see his daughter Morgan here. It's always especially rewarding for me to see Morgan, and Morgan being such a long-term part of this church. Glad you're here.
I will light one final candle for the joys and concerns that we keep in our hearts.
Labor Day weekend always seems like we're closing the door on summer and opening doors to fall and winter. Before we plunge into that busier season, let's pause to be grateful for the blessings of summer. Gratitude for the sunny days and the rainy ones, so welcome after last summer's drought. Gratitude for the vegetables and fruit filling up the farmers' markets. Gratitude for the creative and fun summer services, which have given us the opportunity to know each other better. And gratitude for the people who have touched our lives in special ways, who have made us smile, who have let us know we are loved, who have allowed us to give something of ourselves to them, who have made us feel welcome and accepted. Let us each add our own special gratefulness to this list in these moments of silence. Our centering hymn is going to be out of the Teal Hymnal, number 1053. Morgan and Tracy tell me that it's one with which we aren't all that familiar, and so Tracy's going to sing it through the first time, and then we'll join it in for the second time. And thanks very much to them for being our musicians today.
We have two readings today. Our first reading is from a very popular book known as the Bible. This is from the New International Version. It's been slightly fixed up, as I understand, so sheep and goats have been removed. So I apologize to all the farmers out there if you prefer they belong. This is from Matthew 25, verses 34 through 40. Then the king will say, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The king will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me." Our second reading is an excerpt from a sermon by Paul Tillich. The sermon is based on the Apostle Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 5, verse 20, which reads like this: "Moreover, the law entered that the offense might abound. But where sin abounded, grace did much more abound." Tillich writes, "There are few words more strange to most of us than sin and grace. They are strange just because they are so well known. I should like to suggest another word to you, not as a substitute for the word sin, but as a useful clue in the interpretation of the word sin. Separation. Separation is an aspect of the experience of everyone. Perhaps the word sin has the same root as the word asunder. In any case, sin is separation. To be in the state of sin is to be in the state of separation. And separation is threefold. There is separation among individual lives, separation of a man from himself, and separation of all men from the ground of being. We can say the same thing about grace, for sin and grace are bound to each other. We do not even have a knowledge of sin unless we have already experienced the unity of life, which is grace. And conversely, we could not grasp the meaning of grace without having experienced the separation of life, which is sin. Grace is the reunion of life with life, the reconciliation of the self with itself. Grace is the acceptance of that which is rejected. Do we know what is meant, what it means to be struck by grace? Sometimes, at that moment, a wave of light breaks into our darkness, and it is as though a voice were saying, "You are accepted. You are accepted, accepted by that which is greater than you." In the light of this grace, we perceive the power of grace in our relation to others and to ourselves. We experience the grace of being able to accept the life of another, even if it be hostile and harmful to us. For through grace, we know that it belongs to the same ground to which we belong, and by which we have been accepted. We experience the grace which is able to overcome the tragic separation of the sexes, of the generations, of the nations, of the races, and even the utter strangeness between man and nature. Sometimes grace appears in all these separations to reunite us with those to whom we belong, for life belongs to life.
Back when I was teaching the course Abnormal Psychology, it seemed to me very important to put a human face on the diagnostic labels we were studying. So when a publisher sent me a videotape with a selection of vignettes of hospitalized patients discussing their experiences with craziness, I promptly built it into the course schedule. One vignette featured a young man, Roger, describing his struggle with the voices and destructive thoughts that tormented him and prevented him from being in the world with other people. Medication and an effective therapy program had brought the hallucinations and delusions under control, and Roger was able to participate in day programs and had hopes of getting better. At the end of the interview, Roger was asked, "Do you have anything you'd like to say to the students who will be watching this video?" "Yes," said Roger, and looked straight into the camera. "Jesus loves schizophrenics." The video ended. There was a long silence. We were all quite moved. I thought to myself, this is the essential core of the Christian message. Schizophrenics stand in for all marginalized individuals, for the least of these brothers and sisters of mine. Let us think together why this statement, "Jesus loves schizophrenics," is so powerful. Implicitly, it is both a promise and a command. The promise is, you are held in divine love no matter what. We recognize this as the central tenet of the universalist tradition. Those of us who went to Protestant Sunday school internalized this message when we sang, "Jesus Loves Me." How many of us sang this as our earliest hymn? I bet we still remember it. Come on. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. Little ones to Him belong, they are weak, but He is strong. Come on. Yes, Jesus loves me. Yes, Jesus loves me. Yes, Jesus loves me. The Bible tells me so. Now, I wrote a friend of mine, one of my former students, who was raised Catholic and has continued to be involved in the Catholic tradition. I said, "Sam, did Catholic kids sing Jesus Loves Me?" And she wrote back, you have to understand, Sam has quite a wry sense of humor. She wrote back and said, "No, Catholic kids did not send Jesus Loves Me because He doesn't." Just kidding, she said. The clue is in the second line, "because the Bible tells me so." That would be Protestants. So, I was glad to be straight on that. Jesus loves schizophrenics is a command as well as a promise. Where there is fear or rejection or disdain, let there be love. Research in social psychology, you know you're going to have to listen to some psychology, on the in-group, out-group, we-they distinction offers us some ways to think about the power of this statement, Jesus loves schizophrenics. In the 1970s, Henry Tafel and his colleagues in England studied our tendency to identify with an in-group and favor it over an out-group, you know, like Packers and Bears, liberals and conservatives. Tafel wanted to find a grouping threshold below which there would be no preference or favoring. He had 14 and 15-year-old boys rate pictures by Klee and Kandinsky, that's British, you know, schools, and then told them that they would be grouped according to their preferences, either for Klee or Kandinsky. But of course, the boys were actually assigned randomly and had no idea who else was in their group. They were then taken into a little cubicle and asked to distribute token money to other boys. All each boy knew was the group to which the target boy belonged and a code number. By the way they distributed the token money, the boys favored their own group over the other. Now, it's hard to believe that 15-year-old boys would care whether or not their buddies favored either Klee or Kandinsky. One can imagine that any two artists or musicians or flowers would have produced the same result. This finding has been replicated many times. My favorite is a study out of Colorado, which was done in a large introductory psychology lecture hall. The students were assigned to either Group A or Group B. It was very obvious that this was done randomly, and it was done in front of everyone. Then the subjects were given the opportunity to distribute ratings to each other, knowing only Group A or Group B and a subject number. Sure enough, even under these most minimal of grouping conditions, group favoritism emerged. Now, we're not surprised that people treat those regarded as we better than those seen as they. It is all too easy to find malignant examples of this, such as the George Zimmerman-Trayvon Martin tragedy. or the Palestinian-Israeli stalemate, or the assertion that undocumented immigrants, illegal aliens, have no rights, or the bullying of kids perceived as queer or different. No, what is surprising is how little a difference it takes for the favoring to happen. It would seem that the forming of the social perception of us versus them is as basic as the sensory distinction of figure and ground. All we need to form a we-they distinction is a difference, even a minimal, silly one. Once a we-they distinction is made, a preference follows. Now, this isn't necessarily a bad thing. Where's Barb? UU stewardess committees will tell you that they hope that UUs give more of their charitable dollars to UUs than to other worthy causes. What is troublesome is when a privileged we stigmatizes a marginalized they. This is where we find injustice. Think of white privilege, male privilege, straight privilege. Sociologist Roger Brown theorizes that we favor the in-group because it bolsters our self-esteem. If our group is better, we are better. The increase is stronger in self-esteem is stronger when the out-group is stigmatized. We are better because you are worse. And maybe the worse you are, the better we are. Stigmatization deepens the separation between the in-group and the out-group. For each, the other is a they. And the disparagement cuts both ways. Each group has nasty names for the other. Religion becomes important in our lives when it fulfills our needs for meaning and for connection. Our connections are strengthened when the impulses that sever connection are curbed. The last six of the Ten Commandments admonish people to refrain from acts that come pretty naturally but damage connections. Killing, stealing, lying, infidelity, coveting. Disdaining the out-group also comes naturally. An in-group gains cohesion at the expense of the stigmatized. While this may benefit a privileged in-group, it does so at the long-term expense of community. The great world religions all get this. The golden rule, love thy neighbor as thyself, is found in the Torah, Leviticus 19:18. The Hebrew sage Hillel, when asked to sum up the Torah, said, "That which is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow." That is the whole Torah. The rest is explanation. Go and learn it. Jesus said, "Do to others as you would have them do to you." Muhammad urged his followers, "That which you want for yourself, seek for mankind, that you may be believers." Confucius said, "Never impose on others what you would not choose for yourself." And of course, the first two of the grounding principles for UUs emphasize the worth of every person and the imperative to behave justly and fairly. But here's the tricky part. Love your neighbor as yourself is effective only if there is the experience of self-worth. of being unconditionally loved and lovable. Otherwise, it's no guideline at all. And since we are only too readily aware of our failings, of our missteps, and the negative judgments of others, that sense of worth may be elusive. The social justice movements of the last 50 years have begun with an internal assertion of worth. Black is beautiful. I am woman. Gay pride parades. As those messages bore fruit, so also grew the confidence to demand just treatment and recognition of the unjust consequences of marginalization and stigmatization. And with increasing self-acceptance came the courage to be known, to show who we are, and to share the experience of being a they, of bearing stigma. And that's borne enormous fruit in the collapsing of the we they and the privileged we understanding that there is less difference between them, between us and them, than might have been supposed. Existentialist theologian Paul Tillich's understanding of sin and grace is helpful here. Tillich understands sin as separation from others and from self. Tillich's notion of sin does not carry the heavy baggage of badness that common usage gives it, and I rather prefer Tillich's notion. Rather, sin is estrangement and takes many forms, both garden variety and catastrophic. Roger, as a schizophrenic, experiences separation from his family, from normal people, from the hospital staff, and from himself. His separation is his state of sin, and our state of sin, insofar as we experience him and other crazy folks as them. The studies showing that only minimal differences are needed to produce we-they separations are concrete examples of Tillich's assertion that separation is an aspect of the experience of everyone. Grace for Tillich is the experience of being accepted in the most profound way. I understand it as the profound appreciation of being part of the interconnected web of life, or in Tillich's words, an appreciation of the unity of life. When Roger says Jesus loves schizophrenics, Roger is saying that he has had that experience of grace. That statement for him erases stigma and brings him into a holy circle of acceptance. When we begin our time together on Sunday with a welcome, we are overcoming separation with grace. We are saying, you are not a they to us. Come into our circle of fellowship. That welcome drew me into the UU community. The first time I heard it, I was moved to tears. It is still important to me. The UU congregation Linda and I attend during the winter in Chandler, Arizona, opens every service with a welcoming statement that always seems fresh and original and is as inclusive as the speaker can make it. And I communicated with the worship associate there who's a friend, and I gather that the worship associates have a bit of a competition as to whose welcoming statement can be the most jazzy each week. And it matters. With that welcoming statement, I feel drawn into a holy circle of acceptance. And I imagine you do too. As a psychologist, I came to understand that each of us has hidden aspects of ourselves that we fear, if they became known, would cause us to be cast out of that we. Each of us needs to hear, you are welcome here. You are accepted here. We, they distinctions will not go away. They are part of how social perception works. But we can tackle stigmas. We can open the door to difference. We can call differences into our holy circle and forge a larger we. We are each of us a they in some way. We both experience and cause separation. So we are fortunate that Jesus loves schizophrenics, that we are welcome here, and that grace abounds. Blessed be.
A brotherhood of
We have some time today for a polylog, so if anyone has any comments, insights, and would like to offer them during this time, please raise your hand. An usher will bring around a microphone, and we'll try to answer if you have any questions.
This is Jerry again. First of all, thank you, Sue, for doing this. Thank you for this talk. I am absolutely certain that this is one of the best talks I've heard in this church, and I hope you'll do this again. That being said, I do have one question. Why do I care whether or not Jesus loves me? Jesus being a mythical character, pretty much. Is Jesus a metaphor for what we human beings should do?
Well, I think you gave your own answer, that it's a metaphor, but it's been an enormously powerful metaphor. And when I heard Roger say that, I thought, that's what spread the Christian message. And I'm a fan of the Gnostic tradition, the Gnostic Gospels, and that is certainly at the core, I think, of the Gnostic understanding of the life of Jesus. But that statement just seemed to me to capture what's so terribly important and what made people all over who were primarily down and out think, oh, there's something vital here.
I'm Janice, and I'm reading Karen Armstrong's 12 Steps to Compassionate Living, and it's a beautiful book. I'm only on step 2, but I think compassion is what religion offers the world, and it offers us a chance to not be at war and to have a richer life. And so I really recommend the book, and I on the chapter about compassion for yourself, which isn't always easy either.
My name's Joel. I really appreciated the identifying sin with separation. And I see that as also privilege, and maybe you mentioned that as well. In terms of if a person has privilege, it's as if there's a wall between them and somebody who is on the other side, on the marginalized, oppressed side. What do you see as a catalyst for the person on the privileged side to be able to lower that wall or to cross that separation, that barrier?
I would say empathy, and I alluded to it. I am, of course, personally awed by the changes that have taken place in the receptiveness to queer lifestyles in the last 10 years or so. Never, ever would I have imagined that we'd be talking openly about things like marriage, and now we have a real open struggle to understand the transgendered experience. And I think it's been that process of people allowing themselves to be known and sharing their pain. And the privilege doesn't protect people from pain. And so when the privileged we can connect with the pain of the marginalized other, then that I think that separation begins to blur.
Hi, I'm Tom. And, you know, I'm white, male, straight, so I grew up on the power side of most of those we, us, them kind of lines. But these days I find that that's not necessarily the way things always are. I work in an Indian majority environment every day, and, you know, two levels of management above me are Indian. And so I'm definitely on the outside of the racial issue there. And, you know, my social circle with my wife is UU clergy, which are predominantly female these days. And so I'm in a, you know, in the power relationship in a social setting there. I'm a listener. And so it's... Things aren't the way that they were when I was younger, and I think I see a lot more to both sides.
My name is Lynn, and I think Tom alluded to what my thoughts are. You know, I don't feel marginalized or stigmatized too much here in Waukesha County, but for me, it's when I travel, you know, and you go to international places, and you are different, and you are the minority, and I think that's a really important experience here.
Hi, my name's David, and I've been kind of popping in and out of here throughout the summer, so I've gotten to know some of you. I just want to thank you for your message today. I mean, I came out of a very, it's hard to attach a word to it, but a very Christian fundamentalist church, very rigid, very by the book, as it were. And I just think your message really hit it on top of the head. You know, it's part of the reason I left was the whole us and them. And when you study that, I love to study history. History is fascinating to me, and it's just filled with us and them, and all our conflicts have a lot to do with that. So just want to say I appreciate it.
Thank you, everyone. There'll be more time to talk in the social... Oh, sorry.
Okay, one more.
One more.
Is this on? There we go.
Yeah.
My name is Eric, still. I just wanted to offer a word of insight. This us and them thing and all the ways in which it was presented this morning, one of the maybe unintended backlash or consequences of it might be an opportunity for self-shame. And I just want to offer a cautionary note there. We actually have biological hardware. I mean, we are built to recognize difference. And we've got incredible, massive parallel processing power here. You know, any six-month-old infant can out-recognize our most powerful computers in terms of who's mom and who's dad. So we have the hardware to recognize same and different, self and other. And the first step, you know, you ask, so what do we do, right? How do we deal with this issue of privilege and this recognition? I think that is step one, is notice that it exists. And if you can see that it's there, then you can start to make choices about how does one act? How do I act? Do I continue to do the same or do I change in some way? But when it's invisible, you're not going to do anything because you don't realize it's even there yet. And that's the biggest step. The first step is notice.
Thank you. I'll invite everybody to the social hall. You'll notice when you're in the social hall, there are coffee drinkers and non-coffee drinkers. I'd like you all to mingle anyways. Please join us in our closing hymn, Please Rise, as you're willing and able, and we'll sing number 407. We're going to sit at the welcome table, and let's give it a rousing singing as well.
you won't lead her right.
May the love which overcomes all differences, which heals all wounds, which puts to flight all fears, which reconciles all who are separated, be in us and among us now and always.
When you're down and troubled and you need some love and care, and nothing is going right, close your eyes and think of me, and soon the sky above you grows dark and full of clouds, and that old north wind begins to blow, keep your head together and call my name out loud. Soon you'll hear me knocking at your door, and you just call out my name, and you know wherever I am, I'll come running to see you again. Winter, spring, summer, to know that you've got a friend when people can be so cold. they'll hurt you, yes, and desert you, and take your soul if you let them. Oh, but don't you let them. You just call out my name, and you know wherever I am, I'll come running to see you again. Winter, spring, summer, or fall, all you have to do is